Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, November 3rd, 2024. C. elegans, a research worm, may be the current darling of Nobel Prize-winning scientists, but we can't forget about the humble fruit fly. In this feature article from the October 5th, 2024 issue of Science News, we learn how fruit flies help African research take flight. The humble insects are boosting biology across the continent. By Darren Incorvaya. When Amos Abolaji returned to Nigeria from a year abroad, he brought home a strange souvenir, two jars full of fruit flies. The biochemist had been conducting postdoctoral research at the Federal University of Santa Maria in Brazil on the health effects of certain pollutants. He had used laboratory rodents while working on his PhD in Nigeria and wasn't previously exposed to the use of fruit flies. But when Abolaji joined toxicologist João Batista Teixeira da Rocha's lab in Brazil, he told me he stopped the use of rodents for research. Rocha had switched to using the fruit fly Drosophila melanogaster. After working with Rocha, Abolaji understood the power of fruit flies. The fly has a high degree of advantages compared with rodents, especially in resource-limited regions, Abolaji says. They're cheap, easy to raise, require little lab space, and can bring fast results. And they're poised to boost biomedical research across Africa. When Abolaji returned to Nigeria in 2014 and became a professor at the University of Ibadan, he took his jars and converted his office into a miniature fly lab. He's now a key figure in a growing movement to establish fruit fly research across Africa, where rodents are still the go-to subject in studies of genetics, developmental biology, toxicology, and other fields of biomedical research. In Africa, fruit fly studies can help address urgent public health needs, connect local scientists with the global research community, and build research capabilities across the world's second largest continent. We use the fruit fly as a tool to be able to carry out not just research, Abolaji says, but to raise the next generation of scientists. Animal assistance. Studying animals to gain insights into human biology and medicine goes back millennia, at least as far back as the ancient Greeks. By the 12th century, Arab physician Ibn Zur was testing surgeries on animals before performing them on humans. In the mid-19th century, the Norway rat became a mainstay of lab research because the ubiquitous pest was easily acquired and survived well in captivity. The fruit fly didn't enter the lab until 1900, when Harvard entomologist Charles Woodworth began breeding them en masse for reasons that are not entirely clear. He recommended them to researchers studying genetics, a field still in its infancy at the time, and from there the potential of the flies spread through word of mouth. The Drosophila boom took off in earnest around 1910, after Thomas Hunt Morgan set up his famous fly room at Columbia University. Cluttered with flasks full of flies and bunches of bananas dangling from the ceiling, the fly room hardly compares to the sleek and sterile labs of today. But in that room, Morgan made the groundbreaking discovery that genes are passed down to the next generation on chromosomes. The fruit fly's short life cycle allowed the field of genetics to take flight. Although rats reproduce fast for mammals, pregnancy is typically 21 days, and females reach sexual maturity 2 to 3 months after birth. They have nothing on fruit flies. They can produce a whole new generation in just 10 days. This, plus their small genomes, makes the fruit fly a powerful tool for studying how genes and traits are passed down from one generation to the next. Drosophila are also used to study how embryos develop into adults and to test the biological effects of chemicals. Because rodents are even more closely related to humans, they remain popular model organisms for studying mammal-specific traits and in clinical drug testing. Over the last century, 9 scientists have won Nobel Prizes based on work done with fruit flies. Abolaji's fruit fly lab is in Ibadan, the third most populous city in Nigeria and capital of the southwestern state of Oyo. When I reached him over Zoom, he presented a slideshow of his history with Drosophila. "I thought it would be good if I just share it like a story," he told me. Several years after bringing fruit flies back from Brazil in 2014, Abolaji was approached by Dros Africa, an organization founded in 2013 to expand the use of Drosophila by African biologists. A trio of Spanish researchers started Dros Africa after a workshop in Uganda on using insects in neuroscience research. Physiologist Sadiq Yusuf, who was then the deputy vice chancellor of Kampala International University and later went on to fund a charity supporting research development in Africa called TREND, or Trend, had organized the workshop. The Spanish group had recognized that African researchers were primed to use fruit flies to accelerate the continent's research, which is what had happened in Spain a few decades earlier. From Morgan's fly room, D. melanogaster spread quickly to other research labs in North America and Europe, but not every country caught fly fever. In Spain, virtually no one worked with a fly until Antonio Garcia Bellido returned to his native country after finishing a research fellowship at Caltech in the U.S. in the 1970s. Once home, the developmental biologist established a Drosophila lab. He made many significant contributions, including discovering that embryonic cells cluster together based on what anatomical structure they develop into, with their fate controlled by certain genes. Garcia Bellido, it's been said, put Spain on the scientific map. Then he trained 3 people, and then these 3 people trained other people, says Maria Lola Martin Bermudo, a geneticist at Pablo de Olavide University in Seville, Spain, and a Dros Africa co-founder. Now there are lots of Drosophila labs in Spain. To jumpstart a similar spread of knowledge in Africa, Abolaji and Dros Africa organized a workshop at the University of Ibadan in 2017, which brought in experienced fruit fly researchers from as far as Spain and the United Kingdom to teach attendees Drosophila biology and how the flies can be used to study neurodegeneration, cancer, and toxicology, as well as help with drug discovery. "That workshop was one of the major turning points in my research," Abolaji says. The workshop hosted participants from elsewhere in Africa, including Uganda, Rwanda, and Ghana. One participant, a young woman from northern Nigeria named Rashidatu Abdulaziz, traveled 18 hours over 2 days to attend. Meeting urgent needs. Long before arriving at that workshop, Abdulaziz had already become hooked on fruit flies, but she didn't have a jar of flies from another lab to start her work. She had to catch them herself. She'd read that the flies could be trapped outdoors, but nothing she tried had worked. While earning a master's degree in population genetics, Abdulaziz stayed with her auntie while trying to catch flies in the city of Kaduna in northwestern Nigeria. "Perhaps they don't want to stay far from humans," her auntie suggested. Thinking the flies might prefer human trash to other lures, Abdulaziz left out a bowl of rotten fruit overnight. "I had a dream that I caught lots of Drosophila," Abdulaziz recalls with a laugh. And in the morning, her dream had come true. In 2016, after solving the fly-catching problem, she published an analysis of the genetic variation of Nigeria's D. melanogaster populations. Like Abolaji, Abdulaziz had to learn a lot about Drosophila on her own, but it was worth it. "I began to fall in love with fruit flies because I was just so amazed by the fact that we had so much in common," she says, referring to the 60% of our DNA that we share with fruit flies. And importantly, 75% of the genes that cause disease in humans are also found in the flies. Abdulaziz is now a lecturer, akin to a professor, at her alma mater, Ahmadu Bello University in Zaria. Toward the end of our video call, she took me into the hallway as she headed to a meeting and pointed out the poster on her lab's door, a black and white image of a fruit fly peering through a microscope, with the words "Small Lab, Big Science" blazoned across the top. The big science benefits of Drosophila as a model organism stem from not only its similarities to us, but also its key differences, like being easy to care for. Starting a Drosophila lab can require as little as a jar of flies and a handful of microscopes, while a colony of lab rats can take up an entire room's worth of cages. The ease of using fruit flies is a huge boon for a continent with many local public health concerns, but little local research funding. I desire to carry out research that will have beneficial effects on humans, Abulaji says. Some pollutants in the environment can predispose people to cancer, diabetes, Parkinson's disease, and a whole host of other afflictions, he says, and he uses fruit flies to understand why. One pollutant that Abulaji has studied is 4-vinyl cyclohexene, a byproduct of the manufacturing of pesticides, plastics, and tires. Plastic manufacturing has been growing in Nigeria from 120,000 tons in 2007 to an estimate of more than 500,000 tons in 2020, meaning more and more workers are potentially being exposed to 4-vinyl cyclohexene, or VCH. In monkeys and rats, VCH is known to destroy follicles in ovaries, so there's concern that exposure could cause early menopause in humans. A woman that is working in an environment where such compounds are manufactured or produced or used as byproducts, who is supposed to reach menopause at 56, may reach menopause at age 30 or 35, Abulaji says. But how VCH harms ovarian follicles was elusive. Abulaji got a hint by exposing Drosophila to VCH and analyzing the resulting changes in the fly's gene activity and physiology. The chemical causes the production of toxic types of oxygen-containing molecules, known as free radicals, which damage cells. In Tunisia, Hayat Salami hopes to leverage the power of fruit flies to create a drug screening factory, speeding up the process of identifying new medical treatments. Salami, a medical doctor and researcher, says her journey with Drosophila began with a pair of workshops in 2018 and 2019, hosted by her institution, the University of Sfax, and organized by Dros Africa, and a professional network of scientists called Young Tunisian Researchers in Biology. Impressed by the workshops, university administrators approved creating a Drosophila research unit. Our research unit is the first in Tunisia to use Drosophila as a low-cost model for research, Salami says. She hopes to begin fly research in earnest this year, and once the lab is fully up and running, researchers will be able to quickly screen prospective drugs by testing them on fruit flies. If a drug seems promising, the next step will be tests on rodents. Using Drosophila as a first pass for drugs will save valuable time and money that would otherwise be spent raising and caring for expensive rats and mice. One of Salami's interests is using the flies to test potential antifungal drugs. This is a good opportunity to enhance our university and to have practical research, she says, and lead to better health care for our people. In a 2022 study, 63% of the fungus Candida albicans, collected from a pregnant Tunisian woman's vaginas, was resistant to the common antifungal drug fluconazole. C. albicans is often harmless, but it can cause yeast infections that can lead to rare pregnancy complications. So finding new antifungal drugs is a pressing concern. Building research capacity. The University of Sfax is following in the footsteps of the University of Ibadan, where the small fly lab Abulaji founded in 2014 has blossomed into the separate Drosophila Research and Training Center. It serves as a regional hub for scientists interested in working with fruit flies. Salami hopes that Sfax becomes a hub for North Africa. By investing in fruit fly research, African institutions also now have the chance to join the iconic insect's global fan club. Biologist Ross Kagan of the University of Glasgow in Scotland was one of the Drosophila researchers recruited by Dros Africa to run workshops. He now collaborates with both Abulaji and Salami on medical research that not only has health implications for Africans, but for people globally. "My lab develops some technology we call fly avatar," Kagan says. Using gene editing, specific genetic mutations of individual cancer patients are introduced into fruit flies. The goal is to capture the complexity of a patient's cancer in a group of Drosophila flies to study how those mutated genes affect tumor progression and how the cancer responds to drugs. One of the questions on the table is, what's the difference between a European tumor and an African tumor? Abulaji's team is generating fly avatars that mimic the genetics of Nigerian patients with colorectal cancer. Abulaji is somebody that the more you get to know him, the more impressive he becomes, Kagan says. That collaboration is going beautifully. It is truly growing out of Nigeria. The biggest money for research still lies in Western institutions, and writing grants to get the funding for ambitious projects is difficult, even for scientists in North America and Europe. Western collaborators can help African researchers navigate this path. Salami recently submitted a proposal to Horizon Europe, a 7-year funding initiative of the European Union, in collaboration with Kagan, to support Sfax's research into personalized medicine with fly avatars. Salami and Abulaji have also teamed up to submit a proposal to another EU funding initiative, Erasmus. One thing that makes these international collaborations stand out is that African scientists are guiding the research questions, says Marta Vicente Crespo, co-founder of Dros Africa, and a program manager at the Nairobi-based Consortium for Advanced Research Training in Africa. Often in such collaborations, African researchers get what's been dubbed stuck in the middle. They may collect data, but not analyze or interpret it, while Western scientists lead the project and claim the more prestigious first and last authorship spots on papers. There has been a lot of tokenization, Vicente Crespo says. Things are changing, but very slowly. The legacy of colonization has left many areas of Africa with little capital, which means students looking to do research often have to fund the projects themselves. "We don't have funding," Abdulazir says. "When you come for any of your degrees, you basically sponsor yourself." Because rodents are expensive, students often can't afford to use many, resulting in studies with low sample sizes and thus conclusions that aren't reliable enough to publish. They get their degree, but the science doesn't go anywhere, Vicente Crespo adds. By using Drosophila, money that might have gone to feeding a few rodents for several weeks can instead turn into thousands of flies. Abdulaziz estimates that one mouse costs about 1,000 naira, the Nigerian currency. Buying 80 of them would cost more than many Nigerians make in a month. A fruit fly homecoming. There is a poetic side to D. melanogaster's rise in African research. Like humans, the fruit fly evolved in Africa before spreading around the world. Though they came to dominate the globe through an association with humans, living off our food waste, they once lived more pastoral lives. Researchers in 2018 found a population of D. melanogaster living in a forest in Zimbabwe, unaffiliated with humans. These flies fed and laid their eggs on the fruit of marula plants. The indigenous San people of southern Africa historically collected marula fruit and stored them in caves where the fruit fermented. Researchers speculate that this shared use of marula ultimately sparked the human-fly connection that persists to this day. Abdulaziz is most passionate about the ecology and evolution of fruit flies. For now, though, as the leader of a new research group, she's focusing on more urgent health problems, like lead poisoning, and on inspiring the next generation of Nigerian biologists. We still have people who are yet to accept the fact that we could use these flies for wonderful things, she says. To combat this problem, she founded Drosophore Nigeria, an organization that works to bring Drosophila-based biology lessons into Nigerian secondary schools and trains teachers to use fruit flies in the classroom. Abolashi also stresses the importance of education and training. The ultimate goal is to raise and develop the next generation of scientists in Africa, he says. While international grants and collaborations are important, the ongoing success of Africa's Drosophila-fueled research boom wouldn't be possible without the passion, talent, and resourcefulness of the African scientists leading the way. During our video call, Abolashi showed me the temperature-controlled incubator he uses to raise flies. A new one can cost upward of $10,000, but Abolashi fashioned his out of an old drink chiller, the kind you'd pull a bottle of soda from at the grocery store, for less than $500. Europe will not develop Africa for us. America will not develop Africa for us, Abolashi says. We are the ones to actually build Africa. And a history of Nobel Prize-winning flies goes like this. As of 2023, 9 scientists have earned a Nobel Prize in physiology or medicine for research done with fruit flies. 1933, Thomas Hunt Morgan, a pioneer of fruit fly research, discovered the role that chromosomes play in heredity. He was recommended for the indigenous choice of object for his experiments, which made it possible for Morgan to overtake other prominent genetical scientists who had begun earlier but employed plants or less suitable animals as experimental objects. 1946, Hermann Joseph Müller, in heredity experiments, ascertained that radiation, in the form of X-rays, can produce mutations in genes. In 1995, 3 scientists, Edward B. Lewis, Christiane Nüßlein-Volhardt, and Eric F. Vischaus, discovered genes that control early embryonic development. The fruit fly's fast maturation made it the perfect study subject. It takes a little more than a week for a fertilized egg to develop into a fully formed fly. In 2011, Jules A. Hoffman shared the prize with 2 other scientists for work on the immune system. By studying the fruit fly, he discovered a gene that helps the body recognize invading microbes and activates innate immunity, the first line of defense against pathogens. And in 2017, 3 scientists, Jeffrey C. Hall, Michael Rosbach, and Michael W. Young, discovered the genetic and molecular gears that control the body's inner clock, or circadian rhythm. And fruit flies aren't the only important research subjects. Lab animal all-stars include the roundworm, the zebrafish, the mouse, and the rhesus macaque. The roundworm C. elegans, which was part of the recent Nobel Prize-winning research in physiology and medicine, is 1 millimeter long. C. elegans is popular in studies of genetics and development. In addition to having a short life cycle and being cheap to maintain, the worm can be frozen and revived, unlike other lab animals, and its transparent body makes for easy observation of cells. But C. elegans' simple body, lacking blood, most internal organs, and other features of more complex beings, limits its use as a model of human physiology and disease. its similarity to humans, 65% of disease genes shared. Its age at sexual maturity is 3 days. And its birth rate, more than 140 eggs per day. And then there's the zebrafish, or Danio rerirrio. About as big as a safety pin, the zebrafish is a vertebrate and therefore more like humans than C. elegans or the fruit fly. Because it's easy to keep in the lab and transparent as an embryo, the zebrafish offers advantages over the mouse in studies of genetics and development. But since the fish lacks certain tissues and body parts, such as lungs, it isn't as versatile in physiology and disease research. Its similarity to humans, 80% of disease genes are shared. Its age at sexual maturity is 2 to 4 months, and its birth rate is 200 to 300 eggs per week. And what about the mouse, or Mus musculus? As far as mammals go, the mouse survives well in captivity, and it's similar enough to humans to be a viable choice for studies of disease and even behavior. Still, many health findings in mice don't end up translating to people. Its similarity to humans, more than 90% of disease genes shared. Its age at sexual maturity, 1.5 to 2 months. And its birth rate, 6 to 12 offspring per litter, up to 15 litters per year. And then the rhesus macaque. As a fellow primate, the rhesus macaque is extremely similar to humans as far as basic biology goes, making the monkey valuable in research into infectious diseases such as HIV/AIDS and chronic illnesses, reproduction, aging, drug development, and more. But a long lifespan, slow reproductive cycle, and complex social structure make the monkey difficult and expensive to keep in captivity. And the close kinship to humans has led to ethical questions about using rhesus macaques and other primates in lab experiments. Its similarity to humans, 97.5% of all genes shared. Its age at sexual maturity is 3 to 4 years, and its birth rate is 1 offspring per year. And the author of this article, Darren Incorvalla, is a journalist based in the Western U.S. covering science, health, and the environment. This article, Fruit Flies Help African Research Take Flight, The Humble Insects Are Boosting Biology Across the Continent, appears in the October 5th, 2024 issue of Science News. And you are listening to Science Matters on Sunsounds of Arizona. And next, from the New York Times, posted on October 29th, 2024, written by Amelia Nierenberg, the world's doomsday plant vault gets thousands of new seeds. A storage facility in Norway, built to safeguard crop diversity, recently received more than 30,000 samples as concerns grow about climate change and food insecurity. The Svalbard Global Seed Vault, in the far reaches of northern Norway, is meant to be humanity's last resort. Imagine it as the world's doomsday garden shed, a secure genetic capsule kept safe in case some catastrophe, a meteor strike or climate disaster, perhaps, threatens the planet's crops. The vault already had about 1.3 million seed samples from about 7,000 species sent from all over the world. Last week, it received about 30,000 new ones. The number itself is notable. It's one of the largest one-time additions since the vault opened in 2008. There are often 3 deposits a year. But perhaps more significant is the amount of so-called gene banks, organizations that store their own hordes of seeds in locations around the world that participated in the latest donation, said Asmund Asdal, the Norwegian vault's coordinator. It is more important now that many new gene banks in developing parts of the world are depositing valuable and unique genetic material, he wrote in an email. Some, he said, made their first contributions last week. Svalbard is not the only place where seeds are stored, but it is meant to be a vault, a mostly sealed storage place for use in case of emergency. Most of the work of seed saving, studying, and sharing happens in the gene banks. Those banks are a bit like a computer's filing system, in which documents are stored but easily accessible. Svalbard is the external hard drive from where files can be recovered if lost. In recent years, the vault's organizers have extended their scope. They see their work as a race against time, Mr. Alsdahl said, particularly in reaching out to developing countries or rural communities to protect against the possibility that gene banks could be destroyed by calamities such as severe weather, conflict, or equipment malfunction. As Mike Bollinger, executive director of the Seed Savers Exchange, a nonprofit seed bank in the United States, put it, "If you lose it, it's gone forever." The recruitment push and the size of the latest deposit of the samples reflects the growing stress, the urgency, the need to act in times of climate change, said Stefan Schmitz, executive director of Crop Trust, which operates the Svalbard Vault, alongside the Norwegian government and NordGen, a genetic research center. This time, 23 gene banks made contributions, one of the largest groups to do so in a single window since 2020. There are more than 1,750 gene banks around the world, according to Crop Trust. These deposits reflect a widespread awareness that the climate in which humans have thrived for the past 10,000 years is now gone. Laurie Parsons, an academic at Royal Holloway, University of London, who studies climate change, wrote in an email. Inside the Svalbard vault in 2018, boxes contain seeds from all over the world. The latest donation is one of the largest one-time additions since the vault opened in 2008. The end of the world, at least as humans know it, may not come from a single disaster. Gene banks also guard against the possibility of a gradual demise, and seeds, like eggs, are safer in several baskets. Among the threats, the climate crisis looms large. In 2023, the hottest year on record, around 2.3 billion people faced moderate or severe food insecurity, according to the World Health Organization. Researchers have also found that more than a third of the world's tree species are threatened with extinction. Many of the vault's new seeds come from areas suffering from disastrous floods or raging heat waves, which makes crop production harder. More immediate threats come from human conflict. Fighting has displaced farmers, and bombs have obliterated crops. The first withdrawal from the Svalbard vault happened in 2015, after Syria's civil war devastated a seed bank near Aleppo. Recovery samples were shipped to stores in Lebanon and Morocco. This year, some seeds have arrived from the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories. More will arrive early next year from Sudan, which has been pummeled by hunger and civil war. There are other concerns. Seeds do not keep forever. Genetically modified crops often used in industrial-scale agriculture have edged out older varieties. That can leave local chefs and gardeners who grow and use traditional seeds as important cogs in the machinery of preserving diversity. Dr. Schmitz said he thought that the future of climate-resilient agriculture might rest on seeds that farmers have overlooked for decades. The 1,145 deposits from Chad, for instance, have adapted to withstand a harsh climate. They could be useful to researchers trying to grow crops resistant to heat and irregular rainfall. Mankind forgot, a little bit, the richness, the wealth of what we have, Dr. Schmitz said. Svalbard, an archipelago that is also home to other records of humanity, such as the Arctic Web Archive, a major data storage center, is key to the preservation. But the Arctic is changing. Last year, temperatures there were rising 4 times as fast as in other parts of the world. Melting permafrost led to a small flood at the vault's entrance in 2016. Those issues have since been fixed, Dr. Schmitz said, and the flood water pooled far from the seed stores. Despite the rising temperatures, the seeds should be safe in Svalbard's vault, which stays well below freezing point even without electricity, Dr. Schmitz noted. Nothing, he acknowledged, was 100% sure, but he added, I would say that it is the safest place of all you could find on Earth for such an endeavor. And the author of this article, Amelia Nierenberg, is a breaking news reporter for The Times in London, covering international news. And this article, The World's Doomsday Plant Vault Gets Thousands of New Species, was posted on October 29th, 2024. And now we turn to the September 2024 issue of Scientific American, where commentary on science in the news from the experts in Forum poses climate change is changing astronomy. Astronomy's future may be slipping away, one climate disaster at a time, by Seven Rasmussen. You're evacuating, right? I tapped out on my phone in September 2022. Hurricane Ian was bearing down on Fort Myers, Florida. My father, a Florida native and seasoned shelter-in-place hurricane survivor, texted me his grab-and-go list as he fled his home there. Important paperwork, the dog, 2 outfits. I'm not taking any chances with this one, he said. Days later, when the debris was finally cleared from the roads, we learned just how devastating this one had been. The roof of his concrete riverside bungalow was still there. 2 walls held it up. Everything inside the house was gone, and every house on the block had been swept through. I was 6 months into my second astronomy postdoc then, the culmination of more than a decade of work. I had overcome the odds, summited the mountain of academia to gain a place at the forefront of exoplanet science. We had celebrated my success on my last trip to my father's house, as the golden trail of a Cape Canaveral rocket ripped a seam through the darkening skies. But even then, I had begun to wonder if my place among the stars meant that I was too far from Earth. Those of us born after 1977 have never seen a cooler-than-average year. Since then, the frequency of major hurricanes has doubled, and the incidence of wildfires in northern and central California has quintupled. My generation, those who grew up with the now-silenced clamor of insects, and memories of snow days that don't seem to come around as often anymore, is neither the first nor the last to sound the alarm on our rapidly changing planet. The sirens have been wailing for decades. You might think, as a scientist, I'd be especially attuned to the facts and figures and the dire future they portend. But after a while, the sirens fade into the background and the numbers start to run together. When I think of climate change, I do not think about the data. I think about the shoebox full of things my father found on the lawn. 2 tuba mouthpieces, a waterlogged photograph of me at 11, a $2 bill in a Ziploc bag. I think about the big coat I bought when I moved to Indiana for graduate work that I never wore after my first year because every winter was warmer than the last. I think about the portable air conditioning unit I had to buy when I moved to Tacoma, Washington, a city that wasn't built to endure sweltering summers. Most of all, I think about those to come after me. Before Hurricane Ian, I had never questioned whether I was doing good in the world. Of course, I was contributing as an astronomer. It felt noble, studying what we can never touch or use, science simply for the sake of curiosity. But afterward, I had to ask myself whether it was enough. I could no longer shake the feeling that I was so occupied by other planets that I couldn't see the problems on mine. As astronomers quietly ask themselves about the value of our federally funded science in a disastrous warming world, we must face the reality that the nation's highest halls of power will echo with those questions as well. Just this year, Beltway policymakers sought cuts to both the Chandra X-ray Observatory and the Hubble Space Telescope, ones so severe that they would all but shutter the former. Such cuts are a product, in part, of growing pressures already constraining the budgets of NASA, the National Science Foundation, and other major public sources of funding for space science. We must then consider the fate of our multi-billion dollar journeys into the solar system in a world increasingly subject to multi-billion dollar disasters. Although the projected spending peak has already passed for NASA's latest orbital eye to the sky, the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, which is set to launch in 2027, the space agency has even grander plans on the horizon. They include the Artemis program, which costs more than $7 billion annually, as well as an effort to retrieve rock samples from Mars that is currently undergoing a back-to-the-drawing-board replan after being deemed too expensive. But the project that many astronomers are most excited about is NASA's next great space telescope, the Habitable Worlds Observatory, or HWO, slated to launch in the early 2040s after a multi-decadal development at a projected cost of some $11 billion. Here's the problem. By the 2040s, the world as we know it now will no longer exist. And with those multi-billion dollar crises on the rise, being just one category from climate change's myriad possibilities for fiscal ruin, funding for fixes must come from somewhere. In the 1980s, natural disasters that cost more than $1 billion, inflation adjusted, occurred at an average rate of 3.1 per year, with 297 annual deaths, compared with 17.8 events per year in 2017 to 2021, with 911 annual deaths. Might Roman be NASA's final foray into ambitious orbital observatories? Will HWO make it unscathed to its notional launch pad later this century? The cost for each of the space missions so many of us love is comparable to that of a single climate disaster, a single recovery from an event that now can occur more than 20 times a year. As such calamities become commonplace, space science might begin to look like a luxury we can no longer afford. Staving off climate change's worst effects falls most immediately on the national governments and multinational corporations, fossil fuel companies chief among them, that collectively brought us to this impasse. But after decades of top-down failures, we must take matters into our own hands to push our warming world and ourselves onto a better trajectory from the bottom up. Today, for better or worse, my father's house has been rebuilt just as it was, 20 feet from the water, awaiting the next once-in-a-century storm. But I have uprooted myself. I left my second postdoc, gave away my textbooks, parceled out my in-progress research, closed out my tag-clogged web browser for the last time, and traded it all in for an adjunct professorship. Now I spend my days teaching whoever walks into my classroom about not just the stars above, but how they are connected to the earth below. Astronomy is a joy, a miraculous expression of a universe seeking to know itself. I want to see new astronauts on the moon. I want to learn whether Mars once had life. I want to know whether we're not alone in the galaxy. All this and much more is possible, but the prospects diminish as our global ecosystem degrades. For every step we take to defend that joy, we must take another to defend our climate. Each of us should pause to think about what that looks like for ourselves and our communities. But not for too long. We can leave a better future for those to come only by acting now. The author of this article, Zevin Rasmussen, is a professor at Tacoma Community College, where she teaches physics, astronomy, and astrobiology. She is author of the forthcoming book, Life in Seven Numbers, A Journey into Astrobiology and the Drake Equation, which will be published by Princeton University Press in 2025. This article, Climate Change is Changing Astronomy, appears in Forum, a commentary on science in the news from The Experts. It was published in the September 2024 issue of Scientific American. And now we return to the October 5th, 2024 issue of Science News. 10 Scientists to Watch, a feature article. And last week we heard about 3 of the 10. Now we move on to the next group. Illuminating the movements of Mercury can help mitigate exposure. A profile on Jacqueline Gerson, a biogeochemist at Cornell University. One of the world's richest biodiversity hotspots is Peru's Madre de Dios, a region of the Amazon. But when biogeochemist Jacqueline Gerson first traveled there in 2017, she witnessed deforestation resulting from artisanal and small-scale gold mining. These mining efforts are so prolific in Madre de Dios that they support at least half of the region's economy. But deforestation isn't the only price of that gain. The process to isolate the gold from riverbanked sediments releases fumes of mercury into the air. For Gerson, now at Cornell University, illuminating how toxic contaminants flow through the environment is a calling. She studies how human activities contribute to these contaminants and alter their paths. Globally, people unleash more than 2,000 metric tons of mercury into the air each year. More than 35% of those emissions are generated by small-scale and artisanal miners, making it the leading anthropogenic source. In the environment, bacteria convert the element into the more toxic methylmercury, which bioaccumulates more readily in wildlife and people. Exposure to large amounts of mercury can wreak havoc on the central nervous system, digestive tract, leading to seizures, blindness, sleep loss, memory loss, headaches, muscle weaknesses, or even death. Most of Gerson's work is centered on mercury, but she has studied other hazardous contaminants, such as selenium and sulfur. In most cases, she already has a good idea of where the substances are coming from. It's the rest of the story, where they go, where they end up, that she's after. Before we can better manage and reduce the risks these contaminants pose to people, she says, we need to first understand their fate. In 2018, Gerson returned to Madre de Dios to investigate how communities far upriver of the mining areas become exposed to mercury. Unsurprisingly, areas closest to the mining had the highest mercury levels in the air. But water shed by leaves in the forest canopy, known as throughfall, offered a more complicated picture. The denser the canopy, the more concentrated the mercury in the throughfall. A conservation area called Los Amigos Biological Concession showed the highest loads of any location in the globe, Gerson says. What set Los Amigos apart was its pristine old-growth forest. The large leaves in the mature forest canopy provide wide surfaces for airborne mercury to gather on, accumulate, and later be washed to the ground by rain. It's important to get this information out, says biogeochemist May Gustin of the University of Nevada, Reno. Mercury's impact is more pervasive than people realize, she says. The whole ecosystem is being contaminated. The movements of contaminants aren't the only pathways to which Gerson is bringing attention. Back in the U.S., she is committed to illuminating entryways into science. For instance, she co-authored a 2023 bulletin of the Ecological Society of America article titled, Demystifying the Graduate School Application Process. There's a lot of hidden curricula to getting into grad school and getting onto the science in general, Gerson says. That information is not easily accessible to those who don't already know the process. I'm really passionate about trying to make STEM, which is science, technology, engineering, and math, a lot more inclusive. This profile written by Nick Ogasa. The scientist next profiled is theoretical physicist Nicole Younger-Halpern, who is at the National Institute of Standards and Technology. Steampunk physics investigates thermodynamics in the quantum realm. Picture Victorian London, but its skies are filled with airships. Steam-powered robots crowd the streets, mingling with people in top hats and petticoats. That type of retro-futuristic mashup is the fantasy realm of steampunk, a genre of literature, film, and other art. Theoretical physicist Nicole Younger-Halpern sees her specialty as the real-world version of steampunk. In steampunk, there's this strange juxtaposition of the old setting and futuristic technology, she says. That's what we do in quantum thermodynamics. Thermodynamics describes concepts of heat, work, and energy. The field was born in the 1800s from efforts to understand steam engines. Quantum physics describes phenomena on the scale of atoms, electrons, and the like, and has driven the development of modern technologies such as quantum computers. Quantum thermodynamicists aim to develop tools to describe heat, work, cooling, and efficiency in quantum systems, and determine the limits of performance of quantum devices. Younger-Halpern, a National Institute of Standards and Technology physicist based at the Joint Center for Quantum Information and Computer Science in College Park, Maryland, is at the forefront of those efforts. She has a vision, and she follows it, says quantum physicist Aram Harrow of MIT. She is good also at recruiting other people to her vision. A major contribution has been her exploration of the concept behind Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Imagine a cup of tea. Thermodynamics describes how energy moves from the tea to the air, or how evaporating water molecules escape. Both energy and water molecules are conserved. They move from one place to another, but the total amount is fixed. What if the tea wasn't an entire cup, but a bundle of a few atoms? Younger-Halpern wants to know how the exchange would differ. In quantum physics, conserved quantities can be incompatible. They can't be measured simultaneously. Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which states that the better you know the position of a quantum object, the worse you know its momentum, and vice versa, is an example. For many decades, almost no one really thought about what happens when you have a system and environment that exchange quantities that are incompatible, Younger-Halpern says. But that incompatibility can decrease the amount of entropy or disorder produced in such exchanges. Because entropy in an isolated system tends to increase over time, some scientists think that entropy is related to an arrow of time that distinguishes future from past. So incompatible quantities might hinder a system's ability to experience that arrow of time. Younger-Halpern also aims to put quantum thermodynamics to practical use through autonomous quantum machines. Typical quantum devices, like the quantum bits that make up quantum computers, require constant prodding from experimenters to operate. Last year, she and colleagues developed a quantum refrigerator that automatically cools a quantum bit. It's not just her science that's in the spotlight. Her writing is, too. Her 2022 book, Quantum Steampunk, drew public attention, and she blogs at the website Quantum Frontiers. Writing allows her to explore ideas without the constraints of peer review. Thinking really broadly and wildly, and as creatively as you feel like, she says, is useful for keeping creative in physics. And this profile of Nicole Younger-Halpern, a theoretical physicist, was written by Emily Conover and is part of the feature article, 10 Scientists to Watch, that appears in the October 5th, 2024 issue of Science News. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for joining me today, and please join me again next Sunday.